Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. After day two of the impeachment trial, which was really quite extraordinary. Hey, before we get into all of this with our special guest, Kim Whaley, we are going to be having a Bulwark Plus exclusive live stream tonight with special guest Ben Wittes from Lawfare. And the crew is going to be talking about today's trial. And these are always interesting conversations. So if you join Bulwark Plus, you will have access to that live stream. And in case you haven't taken advantage of the offer that we're making to the hundreds of thousands of people who listen to this podcast, you can get a free 30-day trial membership to Bulwark Plus just by going to thebulwark.com/Charlie. thebulwark.com/Charlie. And you can sign up and you'd be eligible to watch the live stream tonight, as well as, you know, continue to get our newsletters, the Morning Shots Triad, as well as the other podcasts that we have. And this is not the only Bulwark podcast. There is the Secret Podcast, which is not that secret, the Next Level Podcast, and of course, Beg to Differ by Mona Charon, which if you have not tried, it is just absolutely outstanding. So good morning, Kim Whaley. The morning after day two. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, Charlie. Happy to be here.
I have to say that I was surprised by how riveting it was yesterday, and I don't want to be a stan here, but I thought the House managers did an extraordinarily good job of laying out the case, connecting the dots, and really, you know, linking Donald Trump to what happened, not just through the words from January 6th, but through his entire pattern of practice and conduct.
Yeah, as you know, I did a piece for the Bulwark encouraging the calling of witnesses. I still think that would be a helpful step for them to take for a number of reasons, but I too didn't expect it to be so compelling, and it was for a number of reasons. One is, as you indicate, they sort of did this split screen, kind of showing what happened on the Capitol at the same time we're seeing what Donald Trump is saying, tweeting, or not doing. And I think putting it in real time sort of kind of leaves you with little question that he was fully aware of everything that was going on and deliberately allowing it and encouraging it to happen. We also saw new video footage of webcams that were body cams that were on some of these officers. That was super compelling, just how heroic and in the line of danger these people were and how left to twist in the wind they were by the commander in chief. And I think the last piece was the Mike Pence scenario, the, amazing. You know, him, you know, running down the back stairs with his family with shouts to assassinate Mike Pence and the "Where are you, Nancy?" as well. Just that there was this feeling of them actually hunting these members of Congress, and that it was just moments. And by virtue in part of the bravery of the Capitol Police and the Metropolitan Police, that there weren't murders of our elected representatives with Donald Trump seemingly jeering in the background.
That was exactly my take. As you watch this, you get a sense of just the sheer violence, the fact that they were hunting them. And if they would have encountered any of these officials, that they would have encountered Schumer, Romney, Nancy Pelosi, or Mike Pence, they would have assaulted them, and they might have murdered them. I mean, that it is that serious. You know, it was interesting afterwards because I was watching some of the commentary, and the networks were saying, you know, we thought we knew everything about what happened. You know, we thought we had seen all of the angles. There's been tremendous journalism, and yet the House managers managed to keep some of the stuff in their pocket, and so it was fresh, it was new, it was surprising. And there were some videos that I thought were, as you point out, just absolutely chilling, but also, again, connecting Donald Trump to what happened. And I really thought, I'm going to start here, I really thought that one of them that I thought was, you know, particularly powerful was during Joaquin Castro's presentation, where they played the video of a rioter with a bullhorn reading one of Donald Trump's real-time tweets about Mike Pence as they were invading the Capitol. In case you were wondering whether there was any connection between Donald Trump's words and the "Hang Mike Pence" chants, let's just play this. It's about 2 minutes long. Joaquin Castro, one of the congressmen who made a very compelling case, I thought, yesterday.
At 2:24 p.m., he tweeted, quote, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. USA demands the truth. Over an hour and a half into the attack, and this is what he tweeted. And he still, even at this point, did not acknowledge the attack on the Capitol, let alone condemn it. Instead, he further incites the mob against his own vice president, whose life was being threatened. Well, some of you may say, well, who was paying attention anyway? Well, that mob was paying attention.
Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. U.S. demands the truth.
The insurgents amplified President Trump's tweet attacking the vice president with a bullhorn. They were paying attention. And they also followed instructions. In fact, the insurgents were at one point, as you saw, 60 feet away from the vice president and the vice president's family.
Okay, so Kim Whaley.
Yeah, I mean, just to clarify for those who weren't able to watch it, those words from the protester or the rioter through the bullhorn, during the trial, we saw the tweet sort of side by side and split screen while that was happening. And I had to do a double take, Charlie, because at first I said, that doesn't sound like Donald Trump. And then even for someone who follows this carefully, I remember my mind making that connection. Listen, they took the tweet and they used the tweet specifically in the moment to get people riled up and ready for extraordinary violence. And so, you know, if you read the pretrial brief by the defense lawyers, their argument on the facts is, you know, this crowd was completely acting on its own, that you know, right. We are going to disavow Donald Trump from any of it. They were criminals. They committed crimes. Has absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump. That's going to be a really, really hard thing, even for Trump's defense attorneys to articulate with a straight face after yesterday.
No, and as I was watching that, I thought, did I know this? Did I know that this had taken place? Had I really put together that timeline? No, and I thought I'd known this pretty well. So this is a slight digression here, but you know, as I was watching this performance, do you remember the first impeachment trial? Do you remember how the Democrats were kind of boring and they were kind of you know stepping on one another? You know, when you think about the problems of having congressmen being the prosecutors, you have all of these egos and a little bit of jostling and everything. And I think that one of the things we've learned is that, you know, they're not necessarily the best interrogators. They're not necessarily the best prosecutors. And yet yesterday they were coordinated. I mean, somebody helped them with this. I mean, seriously, it feels like they brought in some significant, you know, executive producer who said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do this tightly. We are not going to be redundant. This is what you do. These are the sound bites you use. This is the video you use. This is how we present this in the most compelling manner possible, because the last thing I really expected was that this trial was going to be good television, and it's good television. And right. I'm sorry. I don't mean to insult them, but I don't think the congressmen themselves were able to, you know, produce that particular, narrative as well as what we saw yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, some of us have been scratching our heads for years as to why the Democrats couldn't across the board sort of swiftly pull together a coherent message. And we've seen the Lincoln Project, frankly, do it in the last campaign. And they, on behalf of the rule of law, on behalf of the Constitution against Donald Trump, et cetera. And maybe they took a page from sort of that book. But I should just say, I mean, Jamie Raskin, the House impeachment manager, is really extraordinary. He, you know, he, I've interviewed him also. He is, and as from law professor to law professor, he has a stunning mind when it comes to complex constitutional law. But also, he, you know, he has a really, really personal stake in this. You know, having lost his son tragically, and then days later, he, his daughter and son-in-law come to the Capitol to support him, given the family trauma during this this event that was not anticipated to be this violent. I mean, I think his, he said that his daughter said, listen, I'm not sure I want to go. I don't want it to be dangerous. And he assured her it would be okay, and then tells, you know, in his opening statement the first day, choking back tears, how, you know, he his daughter and son-in-law were behind a door with battering ram, you know, sounds, trying to get through, thinking they were going to die. I mean, so this is a man who not only cares deeply about the Constitution and understands the stakes well beyond Donald Trump, but has a personal stake in seeing justice done. And I think it's unfolding in part because his deep, deep conviction and skill, frankly. I was just really, really impressed with him in particular on how coherent he is and clear he has been. It's really a moment where Americans should feel good about some of their elected members of Congress are doing the right thing for the American people.
So I was going to hold the Jamie Raskin. I have a little soundbite from Jamie Raskin. I was going to hold it for a little bit later, but if I could ask our producer, Jim Swift, let's call an audible and put this up. Jamie Raskin made an interesting point about the free speech defense, that there are limits to it, including, you know, shouting fire in a crowded theater. But he extended the metaphor in a rather interesting way. Let's play the Raskin cut.
First, than someone who falsely shouts fire in a crowded theater. It's more like a case where the town fire chief, who's paid to put out fires, sends a mob not to yell fire in a crowded theater, but to actually set the theater on fire. And who then, when the fire alarms go off and the calls start flooding into the fire department asking for help, does nothing but sit back, encourage the mob to continue its rampage and watch the fire spread on TV with glee and delight. So then we say this fire chief should never be allowed to hold this public job again, and you're fired and you're permanently disqualified, and he objects. And he says, we're violating his free speech rights just because he's pro-mob or pro-fire or whatever it might be. Come on.
So, Kim Whaley, what do you think of that argument?
First of all, I'm glad somebody else says fire like me, because I'm from Buffalo. My kids make fun of me. They say it's fire. But anyway, Jamie Raskin knows exactly what he's doing. And what this is sort of anticipating is the First Amendment argument that we will hear for 16 hours in some capacity from the defense team. And frankly, even some other legal commentators in response to yesterday, I've heard on air, kind of credit the notion that, well, under the Brandenburg test, the First Amendment test for inciting violence, there's an argument that what Donald Trump did was protected speech because, you know, in the Brandenburg case, for example, there was a KKK rally with very strong sort of incendiary words, and the Supreme Court basically said that's protected speech. You can say, you can call someone to do illegal conduct and still have that protected. But this is way off the mark. I mean, what Raskin is doing is a number of things. One is pointing out that there's a difference between a fire chief and somebody in government and a regular person. You know, the First Amendment is there to protect regular people against bullying by the United States government or state government or local government. Donald Trump had the entire federal law enforcement apparatus at his fingertips in addition to the military. His First Amendment rights were not, it's just not the same a situation, and over 144 law professors have weighed in a letter saying, listen, the First Amendment doesn't even apply in this context to impeachment. And the part of the reason it doesn't apply is the other metaphor that Raskin drew, which is that we're talking about firing the fire chief. And here we're not, you know, we're not talking about putting Donald Trump in jail. This is not a criminal trial. We're not even talking about civil liability where he'd have to pay a penalty for, say, libel or slander or something like this. This is about basically a personnel action. He's no longer in office. So does the personnel action extend to keeping him off the ballot in 2024? And Lisa Murkowski made that comment, Republican from Alaska, after yesterday, said, listen, I mean, do we really want this guy potentially doing this again, in if he get were to get four more years? So I think it's really important, that metaphor that he made, that it's just absurd to say that somehow this was protected speech and the rest of America and the thousands at the Capitol and the Capitol police officers and all of those whose lives were either lost or almost lost or maimed or injured for life, that somehow the First Amendment lets Donald Trump do what he did. It's just absurd from a legal standpoint.
Now, this is really a good point. And also, you know, the fact that the President of the United States takes an oath of office to do certain things. And so you, even if you say that he has not committed a statutory crime, the failure to uphold your oath, you know, there ought to be consequences for all of that. And I suppose going back to Jamie Raskin's metaphor, it would be as if somebody ran into the fire chief and said, chief, there's a big fire going on, you know, down in the downtown Woolworths. And the chief says, no, let's ignore it. Okay, so are the words, no, let's ignore it, would they be free speech?
Right.
As you point out, it's right. A personnel matter. It's a completely different category of speech. Your behavior and your actions, your dereliction of duty are not just, you know, free speech matters. So a couple of other things. I have a couple of other sound bites here. And I want to get to what the defense is going to say. I thought that one of the more compelling presentations, and I should have her name right in front of me, the representative from the Virgin Islands, her name is Stacey Plaskett, who made an interesting point about the relationship between the rally and the march, because this is an interesting question about, you know, was this, you know, how did this rally, the clearly Trump and his campaign organized, financed, supported, et cetera, promoted, how did that turn into the march on the Capitol? And I thought you made a point that I hadn't fully understood before yesterday. Let's play Stacey Plaskett.
Women for America First had initially planned for the rally goers to remain at the ellipse until the counting of the state electoral slates first was completed, just like they had remained at Freedom Plaza after the second million MAGA march. In fact, the permit stated in no uncertain terms that the march from the ellipse was not permitted. It was not until after President Trump and his team became involved in the planning that the march from the ellipse to the Capitol came about, in direct contravention of the original permit.
That's interesting to me. And also, you know, I saw somebody ask the question, so why did Donald Trump say that he was going to march with the folks to the Capitol when he didn't clearly do that? And I think it's reasonable to think that he made that announcement because he wanted to make sure that people went. That he wanted to do this, that he intended to take people to the Capitol.
Yeah, you know, Charlie, this whole narrative requires a 9/11 type deep dive commission, because there are so many layers to unpack here. Sheldon Whitehouse, senator from Rhode Island, said on air yesterday that if there hadn't been manufactured, and those are my words, delays in certification of the counting of the votes, it would have been done before the mob would have had time to get there. And of course, the only phone call, like the House impeachment managers indicated, the only phone call Donald Trump made in the hours that this was unfolding was not to the vice president to see if he was okay. It was not to the National Guard or the Defense Department to send in reinforcements. It was to Tommy Tuberville to ask him to further delay the process. So I think what Whitehouse is positing similarly to the clip that you just mentioned, is how much were not just Donald Trump, Donald Trump's campaign, but potentially members of Congress and the Republican caucus aware or even conspired in connection with what the people that were planning this event to actually disrupt it physically on the Capitol. And of course, in this moment, I mean, this is somewhat speculation, but I'm not positing it. These are members of the U.S. Congress that are positing this. And at a minimum, we need to get to the bottom of it. And it also raised the question, are these senators, some of them potentially so compromised that, you know, even though they were victims of the events, which I think was also compelling yesterday to see that, you know, the sort of visceral emotional reactions during and after the presentation to some of these people that live through this. I mean, this was really excruciating for some of them and terrifying. Is kind of the uncovering the truth potentially so damaging that they're going to look the other way? I don't know, but these are questions that the Biden administration and the U.S. Congress absolutely have to address in great detail, regardless of what happens with this trial.
Well, I think that it is fair to say that this is a jury that includes accomplices to Donald Trump. That if in fact, you know, the predicate for all of this was the big deep lie about the election being stolen, then you have people like Josh Hawley and you have people like Ron Johnson and Ted Cruz who told the same lie. And this is what makes this so uncomfortable, that they went along with it. They passed along the same kind of misinformation to people, and people believed it. People believed it. You know, one of the things that really is also another one of the takeaways here, and I want to write a little bit more about it, is the way that Washington and the Republican elite had convinced themselves that Donald Trump's words didn't matter, that his tweets didn't matter, that his lies didn't matter, right? That we weren't paying any attention. It didn't. But all along, there were millions of Americans for whom they did matter, that the words did actually matter, that they took it both literally and seriously. That whole bullshit line about, you know, people knew not, you know, take it seriously, not literally. No, a lot of people actually did. And they were prepared to act on it. So, you know, there's a great piece in the New York Times today. Well, actually, it's a very disturbing piece in the New York Times today about some of the things that the talk radio hosts had said before the election. You know, people like, you know, Glenn Beck, who's completely freaking lost his mind. It's time to fight. It's time to rip and claw and rake. It is time to go to war, as the left went to war 4 years ago. Okay, so I suppose we're supposed to believe that that's just like metaphorical, right? That those are just figures of speech. But what? What are they supposed to mean? You know, I mean, what are they talking about? What do they think that people listening to that, who are being told that the election has been stolen, the democracy is under siege, they're told to rip and claw and rake. What does that mean? Send mean tweets, you know, have angry Facebook posts, peacefully protest? What are they actually asking people to do?
Well, Yeah, we already know what we knew before January 6th, and that's what happened in Michigan. Plot to, you know, kidnap the governor, attempt to overtake the legislature. They had acted on it. And, you know, the hypocrisy and intellectual dishonesty around this is in part troubling, because we've also heard, Charlie, for 4 years about how brilliant Donald Trump is in communicating with his people, right? That is why, you know, he knows how to connect. His big rallies, his tweets, his this, his that. The House impeachment managers mentioned yesterday there were 16 tweets between midnight on the 6th and noon in those 12 hours.
Very interesting.
Encouraging his followers. And then, you know what, when it was time to actually tamp down on the violence, it was radio silence. It was crickets out of Donald Trump's feed, Twitter feed, until he did, for example, call Mike Pence a coward after the shouts were arising to execute him and to hang him. And there was an actual noose that was erected outside of the Capitol, presumably for that purpose. So the idea that it just, you know, the defying basic logic is, it makes my brain hurt, Charlie, but it also in this moment makes my heart hurt because of, you know, watching the sheer bravery. I mean, on the other side, I think the story yesterday was one of good and evil, frankly, because to watch, you know, the Capitol police officers act as decoys decoys to protect our elected representatives of Congress and their staff, to see the this closed circuit video of Mitt Romney doing a 180 and running away from the mob. The same thing with Chuck Schumer. It's just, Tom Cruise couldn't do a better job at keeping us on the edge of our seats and in fear than what the House managers did yesterday. And we're going to see, and it's just, again, it breaks my heart. We're going to see those people having upheld their oaths. That is the members of the Capitol Police Force and the DC police that were doing this with no help from Donald Trump, who had been watching it and refused to lift a finger, despite reports that his own daughter, Jared Kushner, people were saying, please, please, please. He was ignoring it. They adhere to their oaths. They put their lives on the line. But the Republican members of the Senate, they're not going to adhere to their oaths and put themselves in some potential political vulnerability because they're not going to toe the party line with Donald Trump. And I say the party, the Trump party line, not the traditional Republican party line.
But we love you. You're very, very special. Remember this day forever.
Exactly. What are you going to remember, Charlie, right? Raskin did a great job on that. Remember blood. Remember bludgeoning. Remember death. Remember chaos. Remember fear. Is that what he wants? Are we going to have a holiday now?
We love you. You know, Windsor Mann had a tweet. He's really summed up the day in one sentence, that Trump watched with delight what we are watching in horror. And if you were paying, if anybody was paying any attention, they understood that yesterday. You know, what I thought was interesting was, here's a guy who has no problem saying, stop the steal. And, you know, expressing his viewpoint as strongly as possible. And all those people that you just described were on the phone with him saying, tell them to stop the attack. He didn't do it. He wouldn't do it. He was saying, like, well, just stay peaceful. He always has a way of, kind of like, you know, the mob boss who has the way of having a little bit of deniability. So he'll have 10,000 words and he'll throw in, yes, but do it peacefully in the middle of it. And then, of course, that's enough of a fig leaf for Republicans and the pro-Trump media to say that, well, he didn't actually mean it. But, you know, if he did not foment / incite this, then why did everybody in his world think that he had the power to stop it? Right. Why are you calling him if he had nothing to do with this?
Right. And, you know, I did a piece this morning in the Bulwark summarizing yesterday's the highlights. And I mentioned I had interviewed this week Anthony Scaramucci and asked him that very question. I said, you know, and how well, you know, former White House communications director for Donald Trump for famously 11 days, but knew him before that. Does he do that on purpose? He said, absolutely. It's deliberate. He sprinkles that kind of the peaceful word in there, knowing that'll give him plausible deniability later, even though the message is clearly the opposite. And sometimes he oversteps the line, but it's enough. It's enough to give, as you indicate, the Republicans cover. Listen, Charlie, I mean, you know, if I'm no psychologist, but I think what we saw yesterday was a story of a severe sociopath. And when I say that, a person, Donald Trump, who literally has no compassion for human life, that the rest of us are still looking at that, like, how could you not do anything to help these people, particularly given that you ran on law and order, right? You ran on, I'm going to get, if you elect Joe Biden, there's going to be chaos and violence in the streets, and I'm for the police force. But it's because he just didn't care. He didn't care. And that's kind of a counterintuitive concept. We project sort of normal decency and humanity on the people around us because that's how that gives us order in our own lives. Donald Trump doesn't have that chip. It's missing in his brain. And that's why we saw him standing by, like, gleefully, as you indicate, sort of reportedly, sort of stunned. I think someone reported, what was it, Ben Sasse, said that he was surprised other people weren't as delighted as he was the people around him that have been enabling him, but drew the line at this kind of carnage.
Well, and of course, and no, that's where that phone call to Tommy Tuberville comes in, because, you know, he's watching this and he's thinking, this is a way for me to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election. So I'm going to be on the phone, and while the attack is undergoing, I'm going to pursue a parallel strategy to get Tommy Tuberville to object to more states. And Rudy Giuliani called him a little bit later. So clearly he was thinking that what the protesters were doing would help him, and he wanted this to happen. I just, you know, you're right that he lacks the chip. What is so painful for me, what makes my head hurt, makes my heart hurt, is that other people don't see it. That other people who are, I think, probably in their daily lives, good and decent and compassionate human beings, how did they not? How do they look at this? Now, you know, there's only a certain. I'm tired of, you know, talking about the, you know, alternative reality media and everything. But you would think that this would be a moment where, you know, the scales would fall from your eyes and you'd say, okay, wow, this is bad. This is terrible. I've gone this far, but I'm not going to go any further. Sort of what happened with Liz Cheney. That she said, okay, you know, I voted with you 98% of the time or whatever it is, 92% of the time, but I'm just not going here. And yet all these other Republicans are sitting there and they're weaving for themselves excuses not to do the right thing, not to pay attention. Now, maybe they're not as you know, grotesquely awful as Josh Hawley, who is, you know, sitting up in the gallery with his feet up on the desk, basically saying, you know, not only am I not paying attention, not only am I pro-Trump, but, you know, I mean, he's engaging in performative assholery. I mean, it's like, how can I distinguish myself from all of the other assholes, you know, in the caucus? Well, I'm going to do this. So, I mean, there are all these excuses. But, you know, besides the complete sociopath, if you're not a complete sociopath, how are you not moved by this?
Exactly. And let me just, you know, just a little legal point that I just wonder about. And that is, you know, I did a piece a while ago in The Atlantic talking about the kinds of laws that maybe need some revision going forward to avoid this going, this mayhem a second time. But under the Insurrection Act, which is the mechanism whereby a president can actually trigger martial law, that is bring in federal troops, you know, the military to address civilian unrest. The only prerequisite to that is that the president first tell the insurrectionists to go home. So, I don't know what the end game was for Donald Trump, but if this had been more successful in terms of actually overtaking the Capitol, dragging people to the gallows or whatever, and Donald Trump did say to himself, okay, we're now crossed a line where I can step in, that claim for them to be peaceful and go home, that would have given him the legal prerequisite to impose martial law. And I say that because, you know, 2024, friends, you know, if he gets on the ballot again and he walks away unscathed, you know, the people that actually pay for this are the insurrectionists who followed his lead, and some will end up in prison. Over 100 have been arrested. But if he comes back unscathed, that's the future that the Republicans in the Senate are sanctioning for America and for our children. I mean, democracy is fragile. It is not in the bank. It is not our birthright, and it has to be protected. And, you know, they all should be voted out of office, Charlie, if they vote to acquit.
Well, I think this is the most compelling argument I think to make is that if they do not draw a bright red line, this could happen again. This will happen again. And I agree with you that if Donald Trump runs in 2024, you know, in answer to the question, well, why shouldn't you allow him to run in 2024? If he runs in 2024 and he fails again, does anyone think that we won't have the same scenario, including the possibility of even greater violence? You know, what if that crowd had more guns? What if the Capitol Police had not been restrained? I mean, I keep thinking as I was watching this could have been so much worse. I mean, imagine if there had been more shots fired and how many people would have been killed. But you're right. You know, there's two reasons. I think I said this yesterday, that there are two reasons for this trial, why it had to take place. Number one is to hold Donald Trump, you know, accountable for his actual conduct, but also to be a deterrent for the next would-be fascist authoritarian who might want to overturn an election. And this trial had the potential, maybe still does, I'm not that naive, but, you know, to make a strong bipartisan case about all of it. But I worry about this. I mean, I just simply because we've had one coup that fails doesn't mean that we won't have other coups. If you know anything about history, you know that one putsch leads to another putsch. One attempted coup leads to another coup because it has exposed exactly what you just said, Kim, how fragile this all is.
Right. And let me just add, Scaramucci also said, and I refer to him because he knows him personally, that he's going to run for no other reason than he raises a lot of money. You know, he got a lot of money in the last few months with the big lie, and Donald Trump's broke, and he can get his followers to donate a lot of money to him. So we have to proceed. We have to proceed, Charlie, with the expectation that he will run, that this hell, this nightmare is not over unless he's kept off the ballot in 2024. And Raskin made that comment too. The defense is that this was totally appropriate conduct. So if it's totally appropriate conduct, if the Senate says it's totally appropriate conduct, Donald Trump will redo the totally appropriate conduct, or someone like a Josh Hawley or MTG. I don't want to even say her name because giving that energy to that insanity. There are people waiting in the wings to pick up this hell where he left off.
So over the next today's Thursday, while we're taping this, there will be day three of the trial. And then on Friday and Saturday, there will be a defense. Give you an indication of some of the status of the defense, which, by the way, was truly horrible yesterday. I mean, as a lawyer, I mean, you had to be sitting there going, okay, you're the ex-president of the United States. You are a billionaire. You raised $200 million off of this. And you have come up with the worst legal team in America.
Well,
I mean, this guy makes, you know, my cousin Vinny look like Clarence Darrow.
Yeah, no, I taught two law school classes yesterday on Zoom. And the very first question my students put in the Zoom chat was, what did you think of the defense of Trump's lawyers? These are first years, right? Yeah, they've only been in law school for a semester, and they understood that. I mean, a couple things. One is they have terrible, terrible law and terrible facts, and they don't have a burden of proof to rely on, right? Yeah. So if you have terrible law and terrible facts in a criminal trial, what you say is, listen, government hasn't proved this beyond a reasonable doubt. They don't have that here. There isn't. This is, again, a personnel decision. No one's putting Donald Trump in jail. The 100%, you know, the burden, whatever the burden is. I mean, some believe, you know, I interviewed Glenn Kirshner last night. He believes we're beyond a reasonable doubt, well beyond a reasonable doubt. So these are the defenses. One is going to be what we've heard from, you know, Don Jr. on TV. Listen, it was just a couple comments about fighting. Come on, politicians fight. That gets us into the First Amendment question. I just want to, you mentioned Liz Cheney. If there was any First Amendment claim in this story, it was Liz Cheney who stood up to vote for impeachment, and the Republicans acted in response to censure her. That's the kind of political speech the Supreme Court has held that legislators are protected for. That is, if they're going to take political positions, they can't be censured for that. That's the kind of thing that the First Amendment would step in. But these same members of Congress that will trample on her speech will turn around and say inciting a riot is protected. That'll be number one. I have been surprised, frankly, Charlie, there hasn't been more of an argument around intent. We saw this a little bit, I can't remember which impeachment manager it was, that was kind of trying to say you can infer intent, and intent's inferred a lot of time. But what his defense team could do is say, listen, you're putting up a lot of Washington Post summary articles about what people were saying about what Trump was saying. Call those witnesses. If you're not going to call those witnesses, we don't know what he was actually thinking at the time, other than his tweets, and his tweets are ambiguous. That's number two. I think we're going to see this, I said, this silly First Amendment argument. We're going to see a due process argument, but, you know, that's also completely silly. Because he's having process, we're in a trial. That's called process.
Yeah, that is the due process. Well, the less awful of the two attorneys, David Schoen, went on Laura Ingraham's show last night, and I think provided a little bit of a preview of what they're going to say again. Let me just play this and get your reaction to it on the other side.
Say that without wanting to even have to do that. We shouldn't be here. It's an illegitimate, unconstitutional impeachment process, completely lacking in any due process.
I know, but you lost that point.
Start
Don,
to finish.
Don, I understand that, but you lost that point. Oh. I mean, we get it. I mean, I understand that argument. I'm a lawyer, but you lost that point. So now it's on to responding to the issue of incitement. That's the one article you have. So I'm going to ask this question again, because I think there are a lot of people who don't follow the law. I know, but they don't follow the law. because they don't know the law or the law of impeachment. So they see all this video, right. Then they see all these Trump tweets, then they see the fact that he didn't immediately come out and condemn it and tell them to go home. And they say, oh, well, this is just terrible. It is incitement. So you have to show that the other side does that morning, noon, and night for most of Trump's presidency. You got to show that. It's a hint. I'm giving you a hint.
So basically she's trying to help out. She's trying to say, hey, you know, you can't argue the whole constitutionality thing because that motion has been denied. So in a court of law, you just can't keep doing that. And so she's basically saying we just need to do a lot of whataboutism.
Right. I mean, she also, though, made a really good case for, I think, House impeachment managers rebutting his lame defense. And yeah, it will be whataboutism. I was also on C-SPAN and, you know, the Republican line this week was all about whataboutism. You know, that is something that I think is going to appeal to voters or to the American public. That's not something that would be relevant if this were an actual trial. And of course, you know, damaging private property in connection with largely peaceful protests is a far cry from inciting an overthrow of the government. I mean, that's I think the piece, Charlie, that is missed here. This is not a protest. This is not, you know, just even a riot, you know, in the streets someplace. This was, and the impeachment managers made this clear. Donald Trump chose January 6th for a reason. I think the protest was supposed to be later. January 6th was specially chosen. It was handpicked because that's the day that a joint session of Congress was going to count the certified Electoral College votes for Joe Biden by a margin, the same margin that Trump says was a landslide when he was there 4 years earlier. It's that, of course, was exactly what the framers were worried about. And this was in, as you know, Charlie, it's not just in the federal law and state law that you can't incite an insurrection. It's in the 14th Amendment. It's in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which was passed after the Civil War, because the framers at that time were worried about former Confederate leaders running for office and upsetting Reconstruction. So it's specifically, expressly in the Constitution that this is not A-OK. We're in a different land than any other protests that we've seen, at least in, you know, modern.
So talk to me about this. Okay, let us set the impeachment trial aside for a moment. What other remedies are there? You mentioned there is the 14th Amendment, which disqualifies anybody involved in insurrection from public office. There's the possibility of a 9/11 type commission. There's always the possibility of a grand jury investigation into whether or not there was a conspiracy, etc. Which of those options are viable? Are reasonable to think that when this thing is over and he's not convicted, that there's still ways of holding Donald Trump accountable?
Well, we know, of course, that Georgia this week, I don't know if they were emboldened by the presentation yesterday, Georgia prosecutors are investigating potential election fraud, conspiracy, RICO actions in connection with Donald Trump's phone call to Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, asking that he find votes, asking that he essentially commit election fraud. And so that's ongoing and important. It's rare, I think, for prosecutors to announce the way that she did. But that's happening. So that's the executive branch. Of course, Joe Biden under Merrick Garland, who now finally has a hearing date, a confirmation hearing date, could also follow through on potential grand jury or maybe even federal crimes. But that's the executive branch. Your first question had to do with Congress, right? So Congress is laying down all over the place, going out to pasture. Impeachment is irrelevant. Remember, the first time it was, we were acquitting him on obstruction of Congress, so Congress can't meaningfully do oversight anymore because now any president can blow off any request for information. But I did a piece in Politico on that Article 14, Amendment 14, Section 3. At the time Congress passed a statute, just so people understand, the Constitution, you can't just generally walk into court and say, my rights were violated. Right. Congress needs to pass a law that basically gives the court jurisdiction, creates a cause of action. So the Congress did that, you know, 1870, I think, and it made it a misdemeanor to actually run. And of course, historically, it was pretty easy back then to say you're an insurrectionist because you were a leader in the
sure,
the Confederacy.
Easy.
So
yeah.
The proof is going to be a difficult part. But that also allows prosecutors to basically enjoin or arrest someone who is trying to run for office. That's a pretty arcane, outdated mechanism for enforcing the 14th Amendment. But there's nothing precluding this Congress from passing a new statute that would create a civil cause of action. That's how, for example, we have 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. That's how you can sue a police officer for violating your constitutional rights, is because Congress passed a law authorizing a cause of action for another part of the 14th Amendment. So what I suggest is Congress come in, pass a law that says, listen, if somebody who participated in an insurrection, including all those folks that were on the mall, I mean, we know there were some elected officials in that crowd, want to run for office, someone should have a civil cause of action to be able to get them off the ballot. Now, that might be unconstitutional in terms of how that's drafted. There would be a challenge to it. But at least, Charlie, we would see the United States Congress actually functioning as a coordinate branch of government and conducting some measure of oversight of the presidency.
Okay, just two last points that I'd like to just throw up there. Number one, I'm really struck by how quiet the whole Blue Lives Matter movement is after watching those videos. I mean, remember all of that? I mean, all the flags, the blue, thin blue line flags, and, you know, yep. Blue Lives Matter and We Back the Blue and all of this. In that first video that they presented on day one, the 13-minute video, I think the most remarkable thing was, you know, watching all these people going, you know, F the police, and the attack, the viciousness, the total lack of any kind of respect. How can you claim that you support law enforcement and not be absolutely horrified by watching what happened to the cops there? That's number one. Number two, I think it's kind of interesting. The Proud Boys may actually break away from Trump before the Republican Party. Did you see this story about the case of this guy named Dominic Pozzola? Politico has a big story. He was indicted last month on conspiracy charges for his role in the insurrection, and he wants to get out of jail early. So he filed a 15-page motion for leniency, and his lawyers just ripped Donald Trump. Let me just read this. Defendant acted out of a delusional belief that he was a patriot protecting his country. He was responding to the entreaties of the then commander-in-chief President Trump. The president maintained the election had been stolen and it was the duty of loyal citizens to quote-unquote stop the steal. Admittedly, there was no rational basis for the claim, but it is apparent defendant was one of millions of Americans who were misled by the president's deception. Many of those, and I love this line, many of those who heeded his call will be spending substantial portions, if not the remainder of their lives, in prison as a consequence, his attorney wrote. Meanwhile, Donald Trump resumes his life of luxury and privilege.
There you go.
Wow.
I mean, I think they also said yesterday the House impeachment managers made the argument that some of these people actually thought Donald Trump was going to call the National Guard in to help them, not to stop them. So, I mean, the question really, Charlie, is what's left of the Republican Party? I mean, you can't really now be the law and order party legitimately after sort of abandoning law enforcement on the Capitol. You can't, I mean, you're making Matt angry, the sort of the far, far right, the conspiracy people that supported Donald Trump in that moment. And they feel abandoned because they are abandoned. I mean, I know it was reported, I don't know if people at the Bulwark are connected to that there's some talk about a new moderate wing of
centrist
Republican Party. It's just hard to see, other than the Trump Party, that is adherence to someone with a severe personality disorder that just likes chaos and violence. It's really interesting what these senators, the 17 who are on the fence in theory, what these senators see as their path towards ongoing power and privilege in the United States Senate by acquitting Donald Trump. Where are the voters?
Well, as you know, I was talking with Bill Kristol yesterday. I think they've been convincing themselves that they're poised to make a comeback, that they're just fine, that they've, you know, come this far, they've survived this well, and that it really is about power. I heard somebody saying, you know, you wonder why they're not more concerned about the way they're going to be remembered in history. That's a legitimate concern, and I ask that question all the time. But also, at what point do you go, okay, I'm sitting here, I'm a United States Senator, I've taken an oath of office. This, if there was ever a moment to test what my priorities are, what my values are, whether I'm going to put country over party, this is it. And apparently that is not going to be moving more than six Republican senators. And so
I mean, Chuck Rosenberg was on MSNBC. He was a, you know, longtime member of the Justice Department. And he told a story about 9/11, which, of course, was also raised by Ms. Plackett yesterday, Representative Plackett. But yeah, he was talking about these two fighter jets that were, you know, one woman, one of the first that was ever a woman that could was authorized to fly an F-16, and then a young man, and they were told to deploy, and they weren't hot, in Rosenberg's words. That is, there were no guns or any kind of mechanism to take down that plane that was headed for the Capitol, and they went along and did it anyway. Said they knew they would die if they achieved their mission, and it turns out, you know, Flight 93 went down earlier, but if they achieved their mission, they would have died. That's how serious they took their oath of office. And here we've got these cowards with their feet up on the table, fist pumping. This is, of course, Josh Hawley, insurrectionists who maimed and killed law enforcement officers. I don't know how to wrap my head around it, Charlie. All I can say, the good news is, you know, my 11-year-old walks in and out as I do this stuff, and she sees it clear as a bell. I do think there's a time in life where even these people might have had a beating heart to have understood the gravity and gone with their humanity over power. I don't know.
It is one of those tests, and we always wonder how would we answer if we were in fact tested. Sometimes we just never actually know. Well, the Republican Party is going to find out how it reacts to this test, and I am not in any way optimistic whatsoever. Kim Whaley, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Charlie, for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow and do this all over again. Quick reminder that if you want to get a little bit more of the Bulwark take on this, we are going to be having the Bulwark Plus exclusive live stream tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern Time with special guest Ben Wittes from Lawfare. Talk to you tomorrow.